In the studio, I've got Crystal from the Cutty Oi Project. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm windswept after my walk in this morning.
Me too.
It was eye watering stuff. And that does. We always talk about the oi, the grey faced petrel, and it does raise the question: how are they doing? How do they cope with a storm like this?
Yeah.
It's very windy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they do use the wind to come in, so I guess they wouldn't have to try very hard at the moment.
No.
And they'd be crash landing into the bush, which they're really adaptable to as well.
So do they do come to land to shelter?
No, not to shelter, to visit their burrows.
Oh, okay. So if they weren't coming to visit their burrows, they just sit on the water out at sea and
wait it out. They'd just be out in the ocean. They lock in their wings and they can just kind of glide. But, you know, as we've seen, like, seabirds do get washed up and get a bit of a beating in storms like this.
Just no shelter
on the beach.
No shelter out there.
No, no. I mean, who knows? You know, maybe they know how to avoid some of these storms as well and can tuck away in places.
They'd have to fly quite a long way to avoid this one.
Yeah.
The whole country seems to be getting beaten up at the moment.
Yeah.
But you said that actually this time of year they might be on shore anyway.
Yeah, so at the moment we've got adults in burrows sitting on eggs.
Yeah.
So that's exciting, and we're seeing some good activity. So what's happening is that the pair, so the male and female birds, would be taking turns
yes.
on the nest, and so one will sit on the nest for a while, and then the adult will come in and relieve their mate.
Yeah.
And then they can take turns going out to feed.
Okay, and how long do they sit on the eggs for before they start hatching?
Yeah, so probably by August there'll be chicks in burrows.
So it's quite a long wait.
I've just gone a bit rusty on the timeline, but yeah, it's a bit of an incubation time. Yeah, like, 8 or 9 weeks, I think. But
okay,
yeah.
My dad used to have budgies when I was a kid, so he used to breed budgies. So everything in my head's timed by them. But they're quicker, but they're smaller.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are big birds, and they put a lot of energy into this one egg. So, you know, two adults feeding the chick, sitting on the egg, feeding the chick, and then until it fledges in December. So massive input of energy, you know, as they're feeding and then feeding the chick, feeding themselves, coming back and forth. But we do know that if there is any threat to their own survival, or if one of the mates fails or dies, then the other parent will give up and they'll leave the nest and they won't come back
right
until the next year. So they do look after themselves.
Well, you can't. I mean, if it's two person, two bird job.
Yeah, two bird job.
You can't do it with one.
Yeah, yeah. I'm constantly amazed that, you know, they sit in these little burrows in this little one spot, you know, on the coast of New Zealand. And they find these burrows and they find each other, and that whole cycle takes place throughout the year. And they know, they obviously talking to each other, like the timing, everything. It's just so special in how they kind of mate for life. And then sometimes if they lose a mate, it takes a few years for them to come back and find a new one. Mm. So they have like a mourning period. That's what I like to think anyway.
It's a mourning
period. Pretty special, you know, when you think about it, this intimate relationship that these birds have.
They're out in singles bars for a couple of years finding a new partner.
Yeah.
How many years do they actually produce chicks? Bearing in mind that it's one a year by the sounds of it, how many years can they produce offspring?
Well, they're known to live, you know, up to 30, 40 years. So, I'm not too sure how long they then breed. But they have a really high failure rate as well. So it's quite normal for birds, you know, to lose nests, you know, 50% of the time, just naturally. And so we're seeing about, you know, in our nest, we're seeing about 20-25% survival. So we're only kind of, you know, like we've still got a way to go
because
to get to natural survival.
Because of predation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how are the predators at the moment?
The predators are good.
From their perspective?
Yeah, from their perspective.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
No, actually, we've seen the numbers come down a bit. So now that it's getting a bit colder and, you know, we're getting right into winter. So usually in autumn, we get lots of phone calls from landowners and people getting mice and rats in their houses, and we see a lot of activity in the traps. It's definitely dropped off a little bit at the moment, doesn't mean they're not there though. So we're actually doing a big push. We did some monitoring after we'd been filling bait stations for a few months, and we're still seeing really high activity.
Yeah.
So still lots of possums up there, lots of rats. And so so we're only really just starting to kind of dig into that population and knocking it down. Mm. So what we're really wanting to do is create more of a buffer around the mountain, getting more landowners to trap, especially for possums, but also rats. But possums, going possum shooting, if you're into that,
yeah.
Setting a trap in your own backyard, even in town. Like every possum we get is a good one to get because it reduces reproduction. They travel, you know, so we'll get a lot on the fringes. And so if we can do a lot around the mountain, that reinvasion into the forest will be reduced.
So what are the what damage do they actually cause?
They eat a lot of the foliage.
Okay.
But they also predate on eggs and chicks and
okay,
yeah. So they do get into the burrows. We see them around the burrows, loitering around, going inside them even. So
is that something they used to do in their native Australia?
I don't think so. But you know, they've probably adapted, and they are kind of omnivores. They're not, you know, they kind of yeah. scavenge around, and they take whatever they can get.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that's. It's not a one trap fits all scenario, is it? If you're talking from mice all the way up to possums, or how big is a stoat?
Yeah, well, so, yeah, spoats. Well,
a spoat.
Spoats are, well, they're really smart, so they're even harder to catch. Mm. So, so we definitely like to use lots of different traps and different methods of catching all these animals. And actually, at the moment, we're going to do a bit of a call out, and we're going to have some traps available for people to either buy. On a very reduced price, like just a nominal amount,
yeah.
to some traps we've got sitting out there called trapinators. They're possum traps. You stick them on a tree, and if people are keen to either buy them or loan them, we've got a few. We've got a box of them that we're really keen to get out there. So,
okay.
if you're interested and you've been hearing possums on the roof or seeing them in a tree around your house, give us a call and we'll set you up.
And what do you do once you've caught a possum?
Well, there's many things you can do. You can stew it.
Really? Is this just? I'm not even going to ask if anyone. Moving on.
Yeah. Yes, people have just right. you know to answer the unasked question.
Yeah.
But some people dig them into the ground and plant a tree on them and use it yeah. as fertilizer. Or you can just leave it out for harriers to kind of, you know, eat from if you've got harriers on the okay. on your property or flying around.
But if you've got like a small, really small section, you might not. Be comfortable knowing there's a carcass
yeah.
sort of in the corner of the garden.
Yeah, I guess you could dispose of it, you know, just dig it into the garden or ask a friend to dispose of it. Or I don't want to say to put it in the garbage because I don't think that's necessary.
No, I think Extreme has a spot like because the vets always have need to deal with carcasses.
Mm.
And I think there is something up at somewhere on the site. I'd have okay. to ask Extreme, but I think there's something somewhere on the site for dealing with that.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. There's lots of bush areas around Raglan
as well.
Where you can dispose of.
Well, I mean, that's what happens in the wild, possum. Isn't it? An animal dies, it returns back to the earth, basically.
Yeah. yeah, yeah. It doesn't actually take that long to decompose either. It goes pretty quick.
You're a real expert on this sort of thing. How long does a mice versus possum decomposition times? Yeah.
Yeah.
The mice wins.
Yeah. Well, you kind of, yeah, well, that there's that. But also, if we do use any toxins, we monitor how fast the carcasses decompose. And so that we know that it's not left in, you know, the toxin's not residual in the environment.
Are they you were just talking about a trap, like a physical trap, but are toxins being used as well?
We use bait stations on the eastern side of the mountain. We've got a big network.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a pilot where we're looking at using the least the effective toxins, but also the ones that biodegrade the quickest and
yes.
don't leave a residue in the environment. So
yeah, yeah.
So yeah, unfortunately, we're not at a stage yet, like in terms of technology, and that we get all the possums just by trapping or just by shooting.
Trapping actually seems quite hard to be 100% effective.
Yeah, it's always the last ones. You know, there's the yeah. ones, the 5-10% that holds out and will just grow that new population. And that's, we want to get to the stage where we can knock that down.
That and this seems to be another thing too. Like these populations, the predators are ones that grow really fast. And the oi and other endangered species are ones that don't breed very fast, and that seems to be there's a bit of a battle there.
Yeah, yeah. But also taking into the context that possums have come from somewhere else. So in Australia, they're not having the same problem, you know, because the foliage is different, the possums browse on different stuff, and they're actually really struggling there. So, you know, so in their they're own kept in environment.
Check, kept in check by the natural balance over there.
Yeah, and the type of trees. And whereas here, everything's so green and lush. So this is kind of like a smorgasbord for them out you know, in the forest.
They're way more tame over there as well. I was camping over in somewhere in Australia, South Australia, I think. And possums would just walk around amongst people. And, you know, that would never happen here.
Yeah.
They keep well away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I followed this one. Like, it was really close, and I just followed it, and it just kept a couple of metres in front of me, and then it got sick of me and went up a tree.
Oh.
But it wasn't – it didn't – yeah, you just – you don't see them in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless you happen to go up into your roof and there's one there.
Yeah, I do get a lot of them on my roof, and then I know how to reset my trap.
That's the signal.
Yeah, I've got a really good dog too that picks up possum – activity.
I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so you should.
Helps. Yeah.
So speaking of dogs and pets, people should be keeping their dogs on a leash at this point in time.
Yeah,
when
really,
they're out.
Yeah.
What areas should they be careful around?
Yeah, especially around the coastal cliffs and southern end of the beach.
Yeah.
Around indicators as well. So kind of like Manu Bay, you know, southern end of the beach. And it's actually not just for the oi, it's also for the little blue penguins.
Yeah.
So they are also coming out at this time of year and have breeding nests. And they are even more vulnerable because they're obviously waddling down up and down the beach. And we've had numerous little blue penguin brought in or found on the beach with puncture marks from dogs. So we get an analysis done so we know why they died. And often it is from dogs.
Right.
So yeah, and they're obviously also threatened. And we have had breeding pairs, like we even had a little twin pair fledge a few years ago. So they're quite hard to find. But yeah, definitely really good to be aware. Have your dog on a lead, have it under control, you know, don't let it go up into the, you know, into the kind of cliffside areas.
Does it sometimes feel like it's a lot of hard work to barely keep these species going? Well, the oi seems to be growing, but...
Yeah,
like the story of the penguin there, like it's so vulnerable.
Yeah, it is really hard work, but you know, like you got to do hard sometimes. And the really encouraging thing is that since we started, that we have made an improvement.
Yeah,
and over the last month or so, like pretty much every week, I've had people message me saying they've got kaka in their background. You know, kaka.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's pretty exciting. So yeah. It's not just the oi, it's also other forest species that are just, you know, turning up in people's backyard, and people are going, whoa, this is exciting, I don't usually see them. And I've had one family report, like it's been sitting in trees, like a couple of kaka, and then just hanging out for 6-7 weeks. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other side of things, Craig's just emailed me to say the possums come into his house and eat his bananas.
Wow. He's got an open door policy.
Shut the door, Craig. Just shut it and lock it. They might have a key, so lock it.
Yeah.
We'll change the lock.
Tell them to knock before they enter.
Yeah. That's pretty mad.
He'll be wanting to go into that workshop about growing bananas in Raglan. No, there's that workshop coming up.
But if the possum, well, he probably won't though, because he probably think the possums will just eat his trees.
Yeah, so maybe if you want to grow bananas in Raglan, make sure you get rid of the possums first, otherwise you'll have them visiting.
Yeah, well, I'm sure all the people growing interesting things like that, that's a major thing that they have to take care of.
Mm.
But also, you were saying to me before off the air that a lot of landowners trapping, whose properties back onto the bush are trapping at the moment. You're getting more people coming in.
Yeah. Like, so we've got the Backyard Hub, and the Backyard Hub Plus. So we either loan traps, like a trap library, or people can buy them off us, and we help set you up. Or we also have a kind of social enterprise service where we can service the traps and set them up for you.
Yeah.
And that's a paid service. And what we're finding now is sometimes for resource consent reasons, or just for you know, conservation reasons, like people are wanting to protect new planting that they're doing, or native trees, you know, bush blocks that they already have on their property.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of engaging us to do trapping around those bush blocks.
Okay.
And we're basically kind of extending right from Karioi to Toruparu wetland, kind of that area, and all the way out to Aotearoa Harbour.
Remind us,
we've got people trapping all around there.
Remind us where the wetland is?
The wetland's just south of Karioi.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hidden away, but we've got landowners around the wetland that are starting to trap, and so that'll protect those wetland birds as well.
So are those farms, or are they kind of more like lifestyle blocks?
A bit of both, mostly farms.
Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
They're seeing benefits to them, like just the business of running a farm from this?
Well, partly, and also I think a lot of farmers want to do their bit for conservation.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they've got beautiful remnant bush blocks often on their farms, so they want to protect those, and they're fencing them off. They're fencing off waterways and planting around waterways. So, you know, any farmers or lifestyle people that want to do that, they can contact us and we can help you out.
Okay.
Mm.
Should just people can find you online, Karioi Project. That's
Karioi
easy.
Karioi Project on the website, Facebook, Instagram, everything.
Yeah.
Really keen to help landowners that want to do that, because that makes such a difference. Like the amount of possums you can get in a small bush block is crazy.
Yeah.
You might only have 5 or 10 hectares, even less, and you can pull out, you know, 20-30 possums easily.
Wow.
So it's really important that we, you know, just do that bit in your own backyard as well, and it's super helpful to the project.
It's real challenging. Now, a while ago we were talking about you did some extra funding because funding was a little bit more difficult this year than previous years. How is all that? Is that all settled at the moment?
Yeah, so we're still chipping away at, you know, funding applications, and actually since the Give a Little appeal that we did, so we raised over $20,000, which was really exciting.
Yeah.
But we do have a big budget. You know, it's over, just kind of baseline budget is over a couple of $100,000 to keep the team going and all the work we do per year. Yeah.
Right.
And if we want to expand, it costs another couple of hundred a year. So there's big costs involved in continuing running this project. But since the Give a Little appeal, we've had businesses come on board and support, and some of them have put their hand up and said, hey, we want to keep supporting you on a year-by-year basis or for the next 3 years.
Yep.
And so we're kind of meeting with them and talking about what that might look like and what we can give them, you know, the kudos we can give back to them as well.
Yeah.
But most of them just want to do it to support a good cause, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, they're not worried about the reflected glory or anything.
Yeah.
But what can you do? Like, I know that, is it Raglan Chocolate? They've got a little logo on the chocolate.
Yeah. They do the 1% for the planet. That idea. So they kind of said, hey, we want to do that same idea, but then for the project. So they put our logo on their product, and we give them kudos, like, you know, through social media or, you know, giveaways and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We can, you know, so like say if a cafes that are supporting us, like Orca, you know, we might do volunteer nights there. And also a lot of people come and go from those places, so they're really happy to promote, you know, the project, but also what you can do around Karioi, like go for a walk up there, go to Te Tauira Gorge. And so people are really interested, like visitors are interested in getting involved and having a like an authentic kind of experience when they visit Raglan.
If you want to give them the real authentic experience, you should take them on trapping cleanouts.
Yes, yeah.
Trap cleanouts.
Yeah.
We're going up the mountain. There's 10 traps on this trail, and we're going to clean every dead thing out of it.
Yeah, we do that with school groups now already, obviously. Yeah. Like, so we go take them on trapping experiences, and sometimes companies or something come and spend a day with us. But it does have to kind of be balanced out with us, you know, the covering the cost of that and having the staff available to take people.
You should they should turn it into like one of those corporate retreat things.
Yeah.
It could be good money in that.
Yeah, we have thought about that. So who knows, maybe once we've kind of gone through all this crazy COVID kind of stuff and things settle down a bit and tourists are back, we might look at doing some of those things. But on the other hand, like, you know, we're focused on doing the mahi.
Yeah.
And so all that kind of stuff does take a lot of extra time and energy, and sometimes it's that kind of juggling, you know, where do we put our time and energy. So if people want to support and, you know, helping fundraise. I'd love to hear from you too if you've got an idea or if you've got something that you can help us with. It's a community project, so we're really keen to talk to anyone that sees a way that they can use their skills to contribute.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, there was a thing called, this is one example of what governments used to do, the thing called Task Force Green, and people who, I think it was to get people off the dole. And just cleaning up areas where, like, boxthorn or gorse or things like that had gone crazy. And does the government do things like that?
Yeah, a little bit different. Like, I guess they had the Jobs for Nature and kind of in response to COVID, but also got a lot of new projects and a lot of new work done and is being done through kind of this, you know, similar kind of funding stream.
Yeah.
And they do also support project like ours through MSD just to keep people in employment, which is pretty exciting because we're employing 10 people now. A few of us are nearly pretty much full time, but lots of part time roles as well. So we're kind of becoming, you know, a good job provider in the community as well, and they want to support that. So there's sometimes ways that we can tap into that fund as well.
Okay. Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's nice.
So, if I ask you which of the new businesses on board, can you list them, or are we going to get in trouble there?
Orca's one of them.
Yeah.
Yep. And we've got a few others that we're lining up for conversations.
Okay, at the moment.
Yeah. So that's since the, you know, there's other ones like Raglan Chocolate and Morning Glory Coffee. They've got our
logo. Actually quite a few, aren't there? If you look on your website.
Yeah, there's a whole heap. Yeah, yeah. And it's not that I don't remember them. It's just under pressure, Aaron, you know, like I've got to come up with that list.
I know. I was a bit wary asking the question, but I thought it is good to just talk about it, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's so cool. And they, you know, it's not like they're like, you know, just because, you know, that cafe supporting, I'm not going, they all want to support. And, you know, it's not like a competitive thing or anything.
Yeah.
And it's really just lovely seeing that people want to give, you know, and share what they have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like another one, like Mark Frost from Bailey's been like really supportive. We're basically people that are selling their house have done a deal with Bailey's and said, hey, if we sell the house, don't give us a discount, give some money to the Cutio project.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that's, you know, and it's like just a nice creative way of supporting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of like they both give something.
Yeah.
And the landowner or the, you know, the person selling their house does, and then Bailey's kind of does the deal so that some of that, those fees come to us.
Presumably there's businesses and individuals too who receive no benefit from the publicity of it or anything because of the nature of their organisation.
Yeah.
Just people are just giving as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, there's heaps of families. Well, I shouldn't say heaps. But there's, you know, a good dozen or so to 20 families giving on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And we'd love to get more, because that really helps us kind of be able to budget more into the future when we know there's those little bits of money coming in. So we've got families donating up to $25,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's – and it's – yeah, and it all adds up. But did you know when you got into this that you were going to spend a lot of time looking for money and this side of things?
No. What did I see? What's the saying? You know, like – oh, now I can't even think of it. But you know, like when you start something and
if you knew what was it going to be like when you started, you might not have started.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like you kind of start something and you can see the passion and people come alongside and you're like, yeah, we can do this. But you don't think necessarily of the big picture straight away.
Well, you might not. You just don't know.
You kind of do, but you kind of don't think of the detail of what's involved.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like you can't know the detail till you get into it.
Yeah.
So how did it start for you? Like, what was happening? I know that people were randomly just going up the mountain and trapping because they felt like doing it.
Yeah.
That had already been happening. So where did you step in?
Yeah, like, and there was already obviously predator control going on with Doc doing 1080 drops, and then regional council would come in and do private land and hapu land around the mountain.
Yeah.
And Thomas Lord and the family, the hapu on the mountain, were already doing a lot of possum trapping. But how it started, like for me personally, is that I was working at NIWA at the time in Hamilton and driving across the Divi and going, oh, there's no community project on Karioi. Like, I wonder if there's potential to do something. And then at the same time, Malibu Hamilton had hit me up. I'd been involved with the Environment Centre and that, and he said, hey, why don't you do something, like, you know, like...
like Malibu does.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, him and like people like John Lawson, it was a whole bunch of, like, kind of that supported me to kind of approach Doc and say, hey, could we do something? Because we had to get permission.
Oh, yeah.
And then Malibu said, why don't we start an Upper Wainui Reserve? And, you know, it's a small area accessible to, you know, local neighbours, and like it's got tracks already and that. And so we applied for we got permission from Doc by writing a small management plan, and then they gave us a little bit of funding, so we had money to buy some traps, and that's how we started. And I was working as an ecologist, so I kind of shoulder tapped a few other ecologists and said, hey, if I start this, will you help?
Yeah.
And they said yes, and I guess that's what it took to get started, is just knowing that people had my back.
Yeah. And that's a great thing about this community, is that No one looks at you funny, for starters, if you want to do something like this.
Yeah.
Or start a new project on anything. People are like, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And so even at that level, it's supportive, isn't it?
Yeah. And so it took, I mean, I kind of say that really but flippantly, but I think it took over a year of conversations where I'd have coffees with Malibu and like the late Sandy Honoku.
Yeah.
And kind of like we sat down and talked about, you know, what we could do and how we would do it. And so... you know, there was lots of me going, oh, yeah, I'll get around to it. Oh, yeah, I'll get around to it, you know. And so, and then the other great thing was when I wrote the little plan and gave it to Doc, there was a local, you know, a local guy from here who worked for Doc called Ollie Gansel.
Yeah.
And so he came along and said, hey, I'll give you some tech support. So I'd never set a trap in my life when I started. I was a marine and freshwater ecologist.
Yeah.
And, spend, you know, most of my time in streams or in wetlands or estuaries.
Yeah.
And for my work. And so I was kind of like, oh, do I really want to be doing trapping and predator control? So I'd dabbled in some of that for my university studies, and had done a bit of work at Kakapuka, just out the back of Te Amuru. And then, and so I was kind of like, oh, I guess if I work in the forest, at least I'm on the coastline and I can see the sea. So I kind of had to kind of talk myself into it as well, because it's not, you know, it's not as sexy as it, like killing stuff and, you know, rather than like just hanging out on the rocky shore or doing fish stuff or invertebrate, you know, like, so I felt like I had a pretty good job at NIWA, and so did most of this stuff voluntary initially. And it wasn't until a few years later that we'd raised enough funds for me to do less work at NIWA and then eventually do this full time.
I think it was the Environment Centre sort of involved as kind of umbrellaing the project to start with?
Not so much umbrella, but just in partnership. So a lot of our education work we started with the Environment Centre, or, you know, staff from the Environment Centre like Bexy and Danielle.
Because I'm just remembering that someone over there telling me one day a few years ago that this quite large sum of money had arrived in the form of a grant.
And
that was, I think, when things really took off at that point.
Yeah, we got a grant from Lotteries and we applied.
Like, it was a six-figure amount is what I recall.
Yeah. So it was, I think it was about $180,000 or something. And we, at the time, we couldn't apply for it through the trust that I run, Arosha.
Yeah.
Just because Lotteries were, you know, the trustees weren't too sure about applying for kind of gambling type money. Not really gambling, but you know what I mean? Like, so there was some, we had some kind of policy around that we had to kind of talk through whether we wanted to do that. And so the Environment Centre said, oh, we'll apply for it.
Yeah.
So that was really nice. And we still, you know, often talk together and work together. So we really see the project as a partnership with Hapu. Environment Centre, we've had, you know, people like Rick from Extreme and Harbour Care, like, have all come alongside in various ways to help fundraise, to help give advice, all sorts of things. Yeah.
Actually, you're, part of your story there sounds a bit like Rick's, in the sense that he wanted to, because he did marine science and all that sort of thing as well,
yeah,
and wanted to see the harbour sorted out and Fire Eva was like instructed him to sort the rubbish dump out.
Yeah,
and actually did. And yeah, ended up with his hands in the rubbish. Like you had your hands in the traps.
Yeah, like, yeah, true.
A long way from the sea.
Yeah.
Well, you could see the sea,
mm.
but yeah, but I guess it's you do what you got to do if and that's what was required.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it is, you know, I guess it does, I mean, sounds, don't want to sound like a, you know, martyr or anything, but it comes at a little bit of a professional sacrifice, you know, like cushy job, not cushy, but I mean.
You like, had a cushy job.
Yeah, had a cushy job. No, like, I mean, Niue was amazing, you know, and there's so much infrastructure and support, and you go out on your own on a project like this and suddenly you got to figure out how to, you know, fix your own computer or, you know, the printer doesn't work and you don't can't just snap your fingers and go, you know, tech support.
Yeah, welcome to my world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, I want a map. Oh, hold on. You know, like at Niue, just someone whips you up a map, you
right.
know,
oh,
or
amazing.
I need this gear and you buy it. But we're constantly just like looking for funding, looking for support. I think the great thing in this community is like we have so many experts that live here and that have donated their time, you know, people that are ecologists or technical support or whatever, you know, people that, you know, have fundraising knowledge, like Harbourcare. Fiona from Harbourcare has been a massive, massive influence and support around fundraising that we've done. And we're talking over $1 million, you know, so there's a lot of blood, sweat and tears goes into that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so you know, even though, you know, like, yes, I was one of the people that perhaps led it, no man's an island, right? And so, you know, I couldn't have done it without the support and encouragement of all those other people.
You can't. Mm. It's just not possible for one person to sustain anything like that.
And you wouldn't want to.
It would be not as much fun.
No, definitely not. And that was always my little quote is like, if we're not having fun, we're not doing this anymore. So we always got to keep the fun element into, you know, even now working as a team is like, it's hard work, but sometimes you need to have a break and people also need to get a chance to do the bits of the project that they're passionate about. Like, you know, I might do lots of fundraising, I might spend a lot of time behind my desk, but I still give myself the opportunity to go and do some of the field work as well.
Yeah.
You know, so that you keep that passion alive for why you're actually out there doing it.
Hey, folks, we're talking to Crystal from the Karioi Project, and I did say that I was going to be interviewing Sam Judd, but I'm thinking that interview might be next week. I think I might have got the week wrong because he hasn't appeared in the doorway. So I was going to say, so are you networking with other similar groups and other communities? Are you aware of other projects happening around the place?
Yeah. I mean, Doc in the Waikato has been really supportive, so they help us network as well. But right from the start, Malibu and I went to visit the Porongia project with Claire there and joined one of their meetings. We just, you know, earlier this year met with Claire online and just picked her brain around some things that they were doing that we wanted to learn from them. So we've gone, you know, some of our staff have gone over there and learned from some of their guys that have done you know, some bits of the work, and then they learn, you know, transfer knowledge.
Are you?
So it's really cool. Yeah.
Do you know people involved with the Hakaramadas?
I've heard lots about them, but
I just saw something on Facebook last month. They sound quite almost a bit desperate that the foliage on the trees has really been attacked by possums and what have you, and like. Yeah, they sounds like they need a full-on project over there as well.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely doing stuff there. We've also gone for visits to Mangatautri.
That's a special sort of situation, that one.
Yeah. But some of the people that have worked there actually live in this community. They even volunteered on the project. So we kind of are able to sometimes, you know, like just learn by having really skilled volunteers come along that work, you know, in the greater Waikato kind of area. So, but Doc's super supportive as well.
If people don't know what we're talking about when we're talking about Mangatautri, it's got a fence.
Mm, yep.
It's a very, very special fence.
Yeah, expensive one too.
Yeah. I bet. Hey, did you say you had to be somewhere at 10?
Yes, I've got a team meeting. We've got ops meeting this morning at 10. So,
yeah, 10 o'clock is in the morning. Yeah,
it is. Gosh. Yeah.
Hey, look, we should let you go then. But thank you heaps for coming in.
And, thank you, Aaron.
It was interesting. I don't know if I've ever talked with you about how that little starting moment for you. We must have, but I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I mean, I don't talk about it that much, I guess. Seems so long ago. You know, this is 2009. Can you believe that?
Yeah. No. Well, but yes. Yeah. Hey, well, look, thanks for coming in, and we'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Aaron.
And if people want to get involved to help out, just look up Karioi Project online.
Yep,
that'll
we'd
do the
love
job.
To get some business support. Oh, we also, I should, on Jasmine's behalf, also say if you've got any capacity to volunteer, we're looking for a few more volunteers for a variety of jobs that we need doing. So if you're keen to get up the mountain and need to do some fitness going up and down hills, we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, awesome. Cool. All right, see ya.
Thanks.